Hello, I'm Christian Kimball. On behalf of the Dialogue Gospel Study Program, I am delighted to introduce Zion Smiley, Chase Phillips, Andrew Evans, and Ramona Morris, talking about Official Declaration 2 that removed race-related restrictions on the priesthood. The proper thing to do in an introduction is to say, listen to them and then get out of the way. But having listened to them, I'd like to take a minute to share the three things that occur to me as a kind of underline, as a kind of pay attention, folks. First, we need to wrestle with a growing awareness that the restrictions were wrong in the first place, an awareness that positions Official Declaration 2 more as a fix or repair than as a remarkable step forward. Second, we need to acknowledge that people were hurt, that the restrictions were damaging to individuals, damaging to families, damaging to the church as a whole. And third, listening to the voices of young people who were not yet born in 1978, we need to recognize and work to change the fact that the harms continue, that people who would have been or might have been restricted before 1978 are still too often treated as second-class members, that the myths that lead to comments like what's wrong with them or what does God have against them or why are they different, that those myths persist, that they cause harm, that they cause pain and seclusion and separation, even today in 2025. These are important messages. Listen to them.
Hi, this is Ian Smiley. I wanted to speak on Official Declaration number 2 regarding race in the priesthood and offer some of my thoughts for this video series. So really what we're talking about Declaration number 2. We're talking about a people who were barred from being able to participate in the greatest of ordinances in the church and in a greater respect, being unable to access the greatest blessings of this life and the life hereafter. And what you're really talking about there is a spiritual segregation of sorts. And, you know, as a Black member, having grown up in the church and having family members who've, you know, dealt with these things to whatever degree, my family at one point or another fell away from the church, a lot of it due to having to deal with the rationalizations of what has been done in the past in the church in regards to race relations and to spiritual segregation. And it's difficult, you know, if you're a Black member, because the scars and wounds of that era, they don't ever truly go away. They always kind of live with you. They fester inside of you. And, you know, you're able to deal with it at times better than others. I myself have come to accept what has happened. I recognize that while the church itself may be a perfect entity, the members within it are not necessarily perfect. And they've, I believe, mistakes have been made in the past. And, you know, not all decisions, I believe, are of God. I do believe some decisions were of men. And, you know, whether you viewed Declaration number 2 as a divine revelation that moved the church in a new path forward, I choose not to view it in that light. I choose to view it as the church really confirming what had always should have been and what I believe God always intended, which is that all his children have access to these spiritual gifts. And I say better late than never. Even though it's difficult, and we, as members, will, as Black members, we will always struggle. I know that it's difficult for non-members in particular. I remember being a missionary, having to talk to folks who were investigating the church about these things, and it's never easy having those conversations. It's difficult. It's even awkward sometimes. But I do believe that there has always been a place for Black members in this church, and I don't think knowing the past should dissuade people from ever being a part of this gospel and all that it has to offer. I myself have dealt with these things, and I've chosen to stay because I do believe there's blessings for my family, and I do believe that, you know, all things are made right in the hereafter, regardless of what may happen with men. And so those are my thoughts, and, you know, I hope that if nothing else, there will be people that hear these words and are comforted and know that you are not alone if you feel that deep wound because of these things. We all do. But, you know, we have our paths to take, and this is the one I've chosen. Thank you.
Often when we think about the priesthood ban, we often don't think about the role of immigrants. My grandmother was an immigrant, and she immigrated to the United Kingdom during the 1960s, during the Vin Rush era. And because of this, she had the experiences to have a better life. But while she was over there in England, she would have met the missionaries. Now, my grandmother was a woman who was well-researched. She was very highly educated. And, you know, I think that she was so in love with the gospel, then found out that the gospel wasn't for her and that she would not be able to receive the same blessing and ordinances as those who are white. And I think when we think about the priesthood ban, we often have to think about these people who would have tried to find belonging in the place that told them, there's no place for you right now. How faithful do you have to be to hold on in a place that tells you, this is not the place, you don't belong fully? And I think that when we think about that time and that period of time, we can see that it has not just stopped there. It has graduated throughout the church and into church culture, where Black and other people of color are deemed as second-class members because of the fact that we weren't here from the beginning. So when we think about these things, we have to recognize not just that it has happened, but we also have to recognize that there's still many of us who feel that sense of they don't fully belong.
My name is Chase Phillips. I graduated from BYU with a degree in history. I went to law school and currently practice an attorney in the Phoenix metro area. When I think about official declaration 2, race, priesthood, and the temple ban, bittersweet is what comes to my mind. I think of how bitter it must have been for people to join the church, to learn and grow in the gospel of Jesus Christ, and realize that they could not progress all of the way. And I think of how bitter that must have been for people, how hard it was. And then I think of how sweet it is now that people can receive all of those blessings. But as a student of history and also as someone who practices law, I think of what happens behind the scenes, what words mean, what practices were done, how things were done, and that informs so many things moving forward. And so while it was bitter and has provided sweet things, I still think of how the priesthood ban and the ban on temple blessings still has an effect today on people's lives and on the church. And when I think about how these Sunday school lessons are scheduled, it's always seems to be on an off week. So I think of how uncomfortable it is for people to talk about official declaration 2 because of everything that preceded it. And for whatever reason, we don't get that opportunity to discuss it at church in a group setting. And I think it's one of the greatest disservices we do how they schedule that, because it's there, it exists, and it's real, and it affects a lot of people. But I think oftentimes people have the practice that if it doesn't personally affect them, then they don't deal with it. And so that's been an experience I still experience of people saying, well, you know, it was a long time ago and it never affected you personally. And then I think of, I can think of a litany list of life experiences growing up in Southeast Idaho, going to BYU, the things that were said, the things that were believed, the things that were supported by people who I shared faith with, and yet had such different understandings of what the meanings of those things really were. And so for me, it's isolating and frustrating. One of the greatest things for me was an experience being at BYU, being part of the civil rights group at BYU, and having the opportunity to really talk about the priesthood ban, the effect of racism in the church, and how that affected me personally and people who I was with. And it's an experience that I think for me has been formative and continues to be formative, that I have not had the chance since, and assume I probably won't get a chance in award setting. And it's a shame, because it really was a pretty powerful and moving experience to hear and understand people's experiences, how they dealt with it, how they chose to move forward and progress and understand. And for whatever reason, we never talk about that together in a group setting at church. And like I said earlier, it is such a disservice, because when we talk about faith building experiences, testimonies, it's that it's experiences that people have and share. And for whatever reason, we don't. And you know, being a Black member in a predominantly white church, it's isolating. And so I don't always like to bring it up. I don't always like to share, because it's not always a space where I feel like I can or that I want to. As I think about how we move forward and how we progress, it's through, I think, honest, open conversation and dialogue that we talk about actual hard things. We don't just pretend, you know, that it was a long time ago and it didn't happen, but when we realize the residual effects that, you know, still dot our culture and some of the ways we think and talk about things, it can lead to greater growth and understanding. And so that's why I'm grateful that I had an opportunity as part of the BYU Civil Rights Group to do that. And also why I'm happy that I get to participate in this as well, because, you know, while bitter was the fruit of the priesthood and temple ban, it is very sweet to have all of those blessings now and to be able to share that with people. And when we do, it builds community. It helps all of us. And so I think it's important that we take that opportunity to do so.
In 2018, President Nelson gave his landmark talk, The Correct Name of the Church, where he invited us to use the full name of the church instead of the name Mormon. He said, quote, "It is a correction," end quote. I thought that was powerful. It was the first time in my life that I was witnessing institutional repentance, where we, as a church, acknowledged our mistake and were making efforts to change. Growing up in the church, I always made a distinction between being a Latter-day Saint and being a Mormon. I was baptized as a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, not as a Mormon. I remember one time even telling a non-LDS friend that I was a bad example of a Mormon. Another LDS friend overheard me and kind of chastised me in seminary the next day for being a bad example. But I wasn't saying I was a bad example because I was doing anything wrong, though I was kind of a punk at times, but because I didn't fit the Mormon stereotype. I wasn't white, I had no ties to Utah, and I didn't have pioneer ancestry. Even though I grew up listening to Saturday's Warrior and watching the Living Scriptures, I never really considered myself a Mormon because I just didn't fit that stereotype. So to hear President Nelson make the statement gave me confidence that what I had believed was accurate, and it wasn't about branding or cosmetics, but a significant doctrinal position that I'd always held on to. But like I said before, President Nelson offered it as a correction, and I think that's another important thing to understand as we look at Official Declaration Number 2. Not only was the declaration a correction in policy, since we know Black men had previously been ordained to the priesthood by Joseph Smith, but it also shows maybe a correction in how doctrinal and policy decisions are supposed to be made in the church. In this case, President Kimball received a revelation. His counselor, President Tanner, presented the revelation to the Quorum of the Twelve for approval, and then they presented it to the other general authorities. Each quorum approved it unanimously. That pattern was set forth in 1835 with Section 107 in the Doctrine and Covenants. It was previously Section 3, which should indicate how important it is to church organization. In this section, we learn about the organization of the church and how decisions are supposed to be made. In verses 21 through 27, it lays out how the first presidency, the Quorum of the Twelve, and the 70 are equal in authority. In verse 27, it reads, quote, "And every decision made by either of these quorums must be by the unanimous voice of the same. That is, every member in each quorum must be agreed to its decisions in order to make their decisions of the same power or validity one with another." End quote. Brigham Young affirmed that this principle is relevant to doctrinal matters too. In 1861, he said, quote, "In trying all matters of doctrine to make a decision valid, it is necessary to obtain a unanimous voice faith in the decision. In the capacity of a quorum, the three first presidents must be one in their voice. The 12 apostles must be unanimous in their voice. The 70s may decide upon the same principle. Whenever you see these quorums unanimous in their declaration, you may set it down as true." End quote. So maybe, if a policy or a doctrine hasn't been agreed upon in this pattern, we aren't obligated to accept it as correct or true. Section 107 goes on further to say that these decisions, quote, "must be made in all righteousness and holiness and lowliness of heart. And in case that any decision of these quorums is made in unrighteousness, it may be brought before a general assembly of the several quorums," end quote. Now that's interesting. A unanimous decision by a quorum may be made in unrighteousness. A whole quorum, the first presidency, the Quorum of the 12, or the 70, can make a unanimous, unrighteous decision. It's in our scripture. And verse 32 suggests that decisions by one quorum can be appealed by another of equal authority. So from the beginning, the church has been set up with this system of checks and balances, implying that no leader, including the president of the church, is going to be correct 100% of the time, and that any policy or doctrinal decision can be challenged by another quorum. Going back to the priesthood ban, I'm skeptical as to whether this pattern was followed, given Elijah Abel was an ordained 70. I'm not sure whether the racial restrictions were made with unanimity and, quote, "in all righteousness and holiness and lowliness of heart," end quote. Now, this doctrine of righteous unanimity and appealing quorum decisions kind of flies in the face of some of the assumptions we make about how the church is supposed to operate. And some church leaders have made popular statements that appear to ignore or diminish this doctrine. In the Manifesto on Plural Marriage, Wilford Woodruff declared that, quote, "The Lord will never permit me or any other man who stands as president of this church to lead you astray," end quote. He goes as far as to say, "The Lord would remove any president who attempts to lead us astray." Now, I don't mean to imply that every or even any specific church president was going to lead us astray, but there is statistically a 100% mortality rate for church presidents. The Lord has removed every church president in his own time and in his own way and according to his own will, and each president has made changes from the last. President Woodruff never said that God would remove the church president immediately, and God's timetable is much larger than ours, spanning generations of time throughout all eternity. God has a merciful margin of error, especially for his servants, and that may include a level of grace we may be unaccustomed to affording our leaders. But I think it is perfectly consistent with the type of grace I hope God is willing to grant. And I think it is perfectly consistent with the type of grace I think he expects us to develop as we strive to follow Jesus Christ. Charity does, after all, require that we are able to endure all things. But more importantly, when the system of checks and balances is operating and decisions are given validity only when they are unanimous and righteous and upheld by each of the quorums, the president of the church will have the safeguards in place to, quote, "never lead us astray," end quote. I think it is significant and notable that recent doctrinal statements, like the Family Proclamation, the Living Christ, and the Restoration Proclamation, each have the signature of the first presidency and each member of the Quorum of the Twelve. These statements have a lot more weight and authority as doctrine than other statements made by individual church presidents or general authorities. I appreciate the distinction we make between doctrine and policy nowadays. I think it is accurate and useful, but I don't think it is historically accurate. I don't think early church leaders and even church members believed in that distinction. And since the Doctrine and Covenants says that to God, quote, "all things are spiritual, and not at any time were they given a law which was temporal," end quote, I think they were justified in that belief that everything their church leaders told them was hard doctrine. I think we're also a bit obsessed with this, quote, word doctrine. I understand the desire to keep the idea of church doctrine or official doctrine as sacred. But if we can understand doctrine more simply as what is being taught by the church, we can be more open to the truth that doctrines change. They're supposed to. The doctrine of Christ laid out explicitly in the Book of Mormon won't change. But other church doctrines will and should. Quote, we believe all that God has revealed, all that he does now reveal, and we believe that he will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God, end quote. Ongoing revelation is what sets us apart as a church. Some doctrines have changed because we received new light through priesthood channels. Sometimes it appears doctrines have changed due to outside influences. Bruce R. McConkie taught, quote, we spoke with limited understanding without the light and knowledge that has come to the world, end quote. New light doesn't necessarily have to come from within the church. Sometimes we may be compelled to be humble. Many so-called beliefs are the opinions of church leaders long gone, and some of which have been publicly disavowed. Some of these opinions can be insightful or informative, but they're not necessarily binding or authoritative. More beliefs have not changed. In my opinion, the Articles of Faith offer the clearest summary of our beliefs. My parents didn't shield me from troubling church history or teachings. Both my parents, who are also black, converted to the church in 1982. I was born in 1989 and raised LDS. We had a copy of Mormon Doctrine, Doctrines of Salvation, and other books that contain some of this racist doctrine. One of my personal favorites was Mormonism and the Negro by John J. Stewart. I don't think it's intellectually honest to say these racist teachings weren't, quote, church doctrine, because they were very prevalent and very much believed. But they have been clearly disavowed, and I think the church has made some great strides in repenting. Perhaps as we focus more on the doctrine of Christ and what is written in our doctrine and covenants, we will come to a better understanding of what the doctrine of the church should be. When we look at how the Lord has viewed himself in relation to the church, a master of a vineyard or a sower of good seeds, it's clear that sometimes the Lord uses different methods at different times to get us to where he wants us to be. We may need some pruning or digging about or some grafting or dunging. It's not all pleasant, and some methods may seem counterintuitive. In Jacob 5, the Lord admits that he put a portion of his tree in a, quote, poor spot of land, end quote. The race-based priesthood policy could have been an example of this, a sort of, quote, counsel me not policy for his own purposes. And when we look at the scriptural record, we see restrictions on who can receive the gospel and when. We see the priesthood restricted to a specific lineage, and we even see Peter needing to receive a revelation before preaching the gospel to the Gentiles. I think church members are reasonably justified in believing that the restriction may have been put in place by God. But what if it wasn't? What if the priesthood ban was simply a poor, racist decision upheld by church leaders for over a century and based on false doctrine and traditions? What does that mean for us? Several years ago, I visited the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, where four young girls, Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Carol Denise McNair, were murdered by a bomb placed by a white supremacist. I was troubled by the experience. What kind of evil provokes someone to blow up a church? But the church still stands. There is now a monument to the four little girls, and the location serves as a memorial against the evils of racism and bigotry. But it can also be viewed as a testimony of the power of the love of God. Isaiah promised that the Lord would, quote, appoint unto them that mourn in Zion to give unto them beauty for ashes, end quote. In my experience, God has a tendency to create beautiful things out of the ashes of our tragedies. God's willingness to allow bad things to happen allows him to show how powerful his capacity to heal actually is. The damage is still done. Those girls suffered a tragic and senseless death, and Latter-day Saints, black and white, are still suffering from the consequences of racial policies and teachings. Even growing up in the church, long after these things were disavowed, I found myself running into comments, teachings, and policies that were racially insensitive. But I don't hold any grudges. God doesn't want me to. And I do think we are seeing God's power flowing among people of African descent into this church. When I see the Haitian group in my ward, I'm amazed at their faithfulness despite their challenges. My own testimony is stronger, because I knew it never was and never could be reliant on the people in the church or on church leaders. My witness of Jesus Christ is based on my own personal experience. My faith in the church comes from my own faith in God. God's desire is that, quote, every man and and woman might speak in the name of God. End quote. That we might all receive the testimony of Jesus, even the spirit of prophecy. Hopefully, as we learn from this experience in church history, we will be able to do just that.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.